Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic. And before you find it out, I'm going to tell you, I'm a ding-a-ling. You know, Howard mentioning Chuck, I was still drinking, and I went, my wife took me to a meeting where Chuck was speaking, and there were about this many people in the meeting, and you know how, you know Chuck's manner that he has, and he glows, and he has a halo and everything, and I was sitting right down in front. So he would drop some little goodie and then kind of lean over and, ha, ha, and I go. He was looking right through my head, and I knew it, and I got, you know, I just couldn't take it, and I thought, if he does that again, I'm going to leave. I was bombed. So a little while later, he said something and leaned over and, ha, ha, and I, that tears it. And I got up and I, right down the middle of the floor, you know. He quit talking, and I thought I fixed him. So about 6 months later, I was in the program. I was sober now, and Chuck was speaking one night, and I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, Chuck, I would like to, you know, make apologies for the way. He said, Richard, please. He said, you were so dramatic about it. We are so dramatic about everything. I was pretty dramatic about the things that I did drinking, and I'm still dramatic about the things that I do sober. But at least I have a sort of a knowledge of what I'm doing now. But I can't tell you why I came down here to speak following just being down here a year ago, except that my Alabama sponsor wrote to me and said, you all are coming down. And liking to travel, I said, okay. Now, I want to tell you folks something. This is the longest period that I have spent before a speaking engagement. And that's just yesterday and last night, today. But I've been around the country a good deal. And I have never found as warm a group as I have found here. And the acceptance and just the love that you people have. There is a vitality. To me, God is present. And you people are just beautiful. So don't let me hear any more of this jazz about the California stuff. You know, we hear out there from some people, they have cold AA back east. Somebody reminded me today, but we're down south. But anything east of the Mississippi is back east to us. But wherever and whatever, for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm part of the human race. And the first 45 years of my childhood damn near killed me. You know what I'm talking about, man. I wasn't a part of anything. I drank down in Columbus. I was stationed down there during the war. I used to wake up in some strange rooms down there. Clothes scattered all over the room. The only trouble was I was still in them. So I have a lot of memories about the East and the South. And Florida has a lot of memories about me. That's that ding-a-ling story that some people have heard, and I'm delighted. I'd like to mention now that a man came up to me last night, and he said that he had heard me speak at Huntsville last year. And he'd been in the program about a week. And he said, you don't know how you helped me. Well, you folks know what that did for me. And then tonight he came again. And he said, I just want to tell you again what that meant to me. Earl, where are you? Thank you very much. Because you really helped me by telling me that. Because all my life I have felt inadequate. And right away you say, well, if you felt inadequate, why did you become an actor and get into a business like that? I didn't have any more sense than to try it. I never walked on a stage or out in front of a camera that I didn't feel inadequate. You know, before you do something like that, you should have a little bit of an understanding of who you are and where you're going, and I never had any understanding. I just learned lines and walked on and did what I thought was to be done. And I had, at this time, at this point right now, I feel that that my life went the way it was supposed to go. I was supposed to become, maybe not an alcoholic, but I did, or something, because I had to be led to this way of living. I'd gotten so far out, I had lost all contact with, first myself. Anybody could say to me, hello, and I'd say hello, that's fine. But if they said, hello, how are you, they'd gone too far. Now they're getting too close. And I had to back off. When I think about it now, I feel very sorry for that boy that I knew when he was a boy. And as far out and away from everything that he was. And then the man, the so-called man. And I like myself a little better now, which indicates that I like people a little better, because I have to like myself first. And I never did like me. And I didn't want anybody to find out about me. And they did. Both of my grandfathers were ministers. I went to a Bible school, and I was a drop kick out. I dropped and they kicked. I never really joined anything any time in my life. I joined the Army because I liked it. It was sort of a father image to me. I went into the service during the Depression. And then when I came to AA, I had to shoot my way in. Because I came for 8 months drinking or drunk or both. And I'd sit in stag meetings and the guys would tell their stories and I'd say, well, I haven't done what you've done. And I didn't do what you did, and they smiled at me, and they said, you keep drinking, and you will, and I kept drinking, and I did. Right down the middle of the page. These things, I'm convinced now, were supposed to happen to me. And they did. In spades. People told me. I wouldn't listen. I'm not an expert at anything. I think I'm a philosopher. What's the definition of a philosopher? An expert is a person who learns more and more about less and less until he finally learns everything about nothing, and then he becomes a philosopher. I've been rehearsing that one, Ed. There's a big difference in learning lines, learning a script, and getting up on a stage or getting up in front of a camera and doing a job. A professional job. And people have told me at times, they said, well, you know, you don't have any problem because you're a pro. Well, I'm telling you, learning a script, doing it on a stage in front of a camera is one thing. When you get up in front of an AA group, it is something else. And I had to go 3 times before I got up to the room here. I didn't want to get up and walk out again while I was sitting here. Now the strange thing is, don't have to go. We all had the feeling when we came to our first meetings, I'm sure. I couldn't hear too much, but there was a feeling in the room. The people had something. And that it actually made me feel worse. Because I was so sick. And the lights were too bright and the people were too happy and, it was very disconcerting. But I went to my first meeting after sitting in my den one night drinking and crying and crying and drinking and figuring that something had to be done. So I called the local AA number and it happened to be North Hollywood Clubhouse. And they said, well, the meeting's about half over, but why don't you come on down? You don't live too far away. So I took my bottle, got in the car and drove down to the clubhouse. I walked up and down in front of the clubhouse for a while and had a couple of snorts to bolster my courage. You know, you don't know what the hell you're getting into when you go, as Cora Louise said last night, you know what you're getting into when you go into an AA meeting. And I opened the door and stepped into the coffee section of the clubhouse, and there was a guy I'd known out in civilian life. He said, Dick, how are you? And I thought, my God, they're waiting for me. My ego had been reduced while I was sitting home in that den, drinking and crying. And When he said that, it popped right back up again. He took me in and sat me down in the front row. I'm glad he did, because I didn't want anybody to see me, really. Well, you don't know what you're getting into. I was looking for the drunks under the benches and people wrapped up in newspapers and those people, you know. So it was a participation meeting, beginner's meeting on Tuesday night, which, by the way, every 6 weeks I now have the honor and the opportunity of leading in that very same clubhouse. Finally, the leader leaned over the podium. He said, "Does anybody else like to say a few words?" So as I mounted the 3 steps to the scaffold, he looked at me and he said, with a smile, he said, "Have you had anything to drink?" I've never known an alcoholic yet who would admit to more than a couple of fifths, a couple of hogsheads, a couple of tank car. I only had a couple. I said, I've only had a couple. He said, "Why don't you go back and sit down and come back up when you're sober, gently, you know." And I said, "Well, I just want to say," if he says, "Go back and sit down." Now, I'm sensitive. I went back and I sat down, and I thought, well, he is a slob, but I will be a gentleman, and I'll stay here. And I stayed till the meeting was over. And then I couldn't get out fast enough, because all these people, you know, were so happy and shaking hands and slapping each other on the back. So I did go home that night, walked in the house after a few more belts, put my hand up on the door jamb, looked at my wife, and says, "My name is Dick Webb. I'm an alcoholic." I did make the admission. I kept going to meetings, drinking, or drunk, or both, and it took 8 months before everything went to hell in a handbasket, and I came down the home stretch and went belly up, as my partner says. And the moment arrived when God, as I understand him, laid it right in my lap. "What are you going to do, son? Come or go?" And my last 10 days of drinking, I drank 2/5 a day for those 10 days. I thought that was pretty good, 2/5 a day. And I was sitting in a barber shop one day, and a smart barber told one of his clients who was sitting in the chair, "This guy's an alcoholic, you know, he's a drunk." And I said, "Is that right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "How much did you drink?" I said, "Oh, 2/5 a day for 10 days. He said, "That's pretty good." I said, "Yeah, I thought it was." And he said, "I had a friend that drank 5/5. I said, "You mean 5/5 of booze a day?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "What happened to him?" He said, "He died." Where was it, Cora Louise? I said, before I got up here, I told Cora Louise, I said, "Sometimes I get off the track." I said, "Now you have to listen, because you got to tell me where I was." But my last day of my drinking of those 10 days, that last day, my wife said she had never seen me stagger. I was one of those gentlemanly drunks. You know, I never staggered. I never fell down. I wasn't that type. I always walked straight, articulated. Of course, my left eye was clear over in the corner, and my wife knew I was gone. But I had started to drink pretty early that day, and I drove back up to the house. I'd been over visiting some friends who had booze. And my wife said, as I got out of the car and came around it, I staggered. And now, she had been going to Al-Anon during those last eight months of my drinking. And this day, now my wife sleeps late. She really sleeps late. This day, for some unknown reason, she'd gotten up, dressed, and she had her running shoes on. As I walked in the house, took off my coat, kicked off my shoes, looked at her, says, "Now I'm going to kill you." And with this, started at her and pulled the table over and busted everything. She took off out the side door. So I busted up the house and then went in. Got my .357 Magnum revolver, fully loaded, cocked it, stuck it in my mouth, and sat there meditating. I told that story one time, and the guy said, "That's about all you could do at a time like that." Then I got scared, because nobody tried to stop me. I wanted to die, and I wanted to stay, and I knew that something had to give, and I didn't know how it was going to happen. And then the thought came to me, my friends will do this job, the Van Nuys police. They had guns, and they could do what I was afraid to do. So I called them up, and I got Scotty on the phone. I found out later. I told Scotty what I had in mind. Van Nuys police were to come out and were to have a gunfight in my front yard. So Scotty told me what he thought about the idea. It wasn't very complimentary. But to convince him, I fired the gun alongside the phone. And a Magnum is pretty loud anyhow, and in a small room, there was a short silence while Scotty said later as he got up off the floor and changed ears. And he said, where do you live, Mr. Webb? And I told him. He said, we'll be over shortly. I said, thank you very much. All very dignified. Great self-respect. I was barefooted, had on a pair of slacks, no shirt, a Sam Brown belt, and that .357 Magnum. I don't know how much later it was that my mother, who was in a wheelchair, had retired to her room to get out of the line of action. She called in, she said, there's some men in the front yard. And I said, thank you very much. Checked the gun to see it was fully loaded, put it in the holster, started out down the hall, and as I turned the corner, I stopped and combed my hair in the mirror that I have there on the wall. Can't go out to a thing like that with your hair all messed up. So when I said I was a ding-a-ling, I was qualified. So I stepped outside the door, and Scotty was there. So I had done a series called U.S. Border Patrol. So I sensed figures, things around. I didn't know how many were there. I found out later there were 12. There were a dozen police. They all came out to see the show. I said, you draw first. I think I can beat you. Because I wanted them to kill me. I didn't want to kill them. They were my friends, but they had to do this job I was afraid to do. I could feel the bullets hitting me, and man, they were going to let the air and the sunlight through, and then I wouldn't have to suffer anymore. So Scotty kept me talking. Three of them jumped on me from the roof, and the next I remember, I'm lying on the floor of the back seat of the police car on my stomach, handcuffed. Two of the cops had their feet on my back. They're smoking cigarettes. I'm looking at them and saying, hey, fellas, let's go back and do it again. This isn't what I meant. They ruined my script. So, took me over and booked me. I had two series on the air at the time, and of course you know how the news media loves to get a hold of something like that. See, I was supposed to do it in spades, and I did it in with a big shovel. So they came out on the front page for about 3 days. Captain Midnight gets off Ovaltine, all this jazz. I usually don't tell the story. We had a wonderful meeting last night, wasn't it? That group of us that sat down at that table until almost 2 o'clock this morning, talking. And all these things came back to me. And I very seldom have told the story of what happened to me when I was in jail because I used to be attacked for it. But last night, the thing came out, and there's to me in this group here, this particular time, these 3 days, there's such a tremendous spiritual feeling that I just felt that I wanted to relate what happened to me. I woke up, came to, I don't know what time in the morning it was, maybe 4. That's normally when I'd come to after I'd been drinking my 2/5, and usually I'd get my .357 Magnum and go from window to window to see who was out there, you know, because they were out there. I don't know who it was, but they were there. I woke up, and I was naked. Metal bunk, 2,000-watt bulb in the ceiling, and mirrors so they could watch me in the front office. You know. And all of a sudden, I seemed to be standing here watching myself. And I heard my voice say, God, I'm naked. And I embraced the flame, and there was a bar, one of those cell bars. It was a new jail, nice chrome bars, if you like jails. And I walked over and put my arms around it, and it didn't burn me, and then it just faded away. Well, I told that story a couple of times, and guys would come up and say, well, you got it made. You had a spiritual experience. And all that. Well, as I told Ed last night, I said, then I found a story to kind of take the sting off of that. Protestant was sitting next to the Catholic priest at ringside. The bell rang for the fight. One of the fighters got up and crossed himself, and the Protestant said, Father, does that help? The priest looked at him. He says, only if he can fight, my son, only if he can fight. So I feel the same way about that. But what kind of a boy, what kind of a character became that kind of a character? Because I wasn't, they tell me when I was a little boy that I was very happy. And people used to like to talk to me because I was so bright and I seemed to be so full of life and everything. Now what happened to a personality like that as time went on? Now we know that alcoholism is an outward manifestation of a deeper-seated emotional upheaval. I was an emotional cripple long before I ever took my first drink. And when I did take my first drink, I waited for rockets and firecrackers or to be blown up. Or nothing happened except that I I felt warm, and I felt a glow. So I'd only bought a pint. I'd walked up and down in front of the booze store for quite some time trying to think what to get. And what did the guys talk about, you know, when they talked about booze? I'd never had a drink. Age 19. Finally, I saw it was a slow gin. Or apricot brandy. I think it was apricot brandy. And I thought, oh, it's got vitamins in it. It's got fruit. So I bought that brandy, and I bought a bottle of Coke along with it and took them out behind the booze store, poured out the Coke, and poured the apricot brandy in the Coke bottle. Nobody was watching me, and I was already hiding it. So I had the first indications that I was an alcoholic. So I took that first couple of snorts and got very comfortable, and I ultimately finished the whole thing. Number two, I drank the whole bottle. I went on a date. I don't remember how long I stayed there. I think she wanted a drink, and I told her it'd be bad for her, and I didn't give her any. Next thing I remember, I was down at Jefferson Barracks, St. Louis, Missouri. I was standing in front of the medical building. It was very cool, and boom, I passed out. Well, I had been walking in a blackout. Number three, I had a blackout. Number four, I passed out. I had four indications with my first drink that I was an alcoholic, as we know it today, as they are now teaching it in schools. So my drinking never really posed a problem except when I drank. And I really didn't drink that much. Now, it is said about the alcoholic that we can't stand success and we can't stand failure. And I used to drink real heavy when I thought I was going to fail. Well, my wife and I went back to New York and lived in a cold water walk-up down on West 45th Street. And I used to buy rum because it was cheaper, Ron Rico rum, drink that. But tonight, as my commercial, I'm appearing here through the courtesy of Smirnoff Vodka. Now we take the same emotionally sick character, and in his particular line of work, we give him a fair success. And he's pretty well known around the country on television. The last year of my drinking was the best year I ever had financially. And that's when I went belly up and hit bottom. Because I had all the booze in the house that I needed. I didn't have to go anyplace. Guys would say, well, you know, you used to drive. I said, don't tell me how I drank. I said, I was large. I had it right in the house. And I did most of my drinking in the house. I didn't drink in bars. I didn't associate with people too much. I was antisocial, sober. But I drank in my house. My agent was sitting across the room from me one night. And I was sitting in my favorite shooting chair up at the head of the room. I had my .357 Magnum revolver with me. He was about half bagged. And I just pulled it up from the hip. Boom! At him. He looked at me and he says, it cracks when it goes by. He's the man who sent me my copy of the big book about 3 days later. He didn't bring it, he sent it. That time, I still wasn't ready. You see, shooting at another person made a lot of sense to me, because any so-called normal person would have been horrified at what they'd almost done. I missed him about 3 inches. The hole is still in the sash of the window. I replaced the glass. I replaced a lot of glass when I was drinking. My only thought was, next time I'll aim. You know, there are many of us are in prison for life, up for murder and so on, because of this very thing that I did, booze. I could have killed this man because I hated myself. But you don't kill yourself. You kill somebody else. Take it out on them. Just a few other things. I think I told that when I was down here before. My story isn't too different than it was last year. My walnut tree out in my front yard. I used to drink up in that walnut tree. I was buying my vodka in those half-gallon decanters, you know, in a cradle, and put a nozzle on it and set it up high, just walk by, I'd hit it every once in a while. And then wait for my wife to make a comment so I could really drink. But I'd get comfortable and go outside the door around up in that walnut tree where I had another bottle hidden up there. When I told the psychiatrist about it, she said, what did you think about up there, Mr. Webb? And I says, what does any 44-year-old ape think about up in a tree with a jug? You get the picture. I thought, nobody knows where I am. And she said, whom did you think cared? Now that hurt me. That hurts any of us when we're down at the bottom of our drinking career. Because we want love and we want understanding and we are screaming and dying inside and we are pushing away from us the exact thing that we want. Love and understanding. And here I am squatting up on a branch in a tree with a bottle, just knowing that everybody would want to know where I was. I still have the walnut tree. Haven't been up in it quite a while. But every once in a while, I'll go out, I'll be passing it, and I'll just stop and look up. It's still up there. It's a change in my thinking, a change in my attitude. I would rather be here than I would be there. I'd rather be doing what I'm doing now than anything that I was doing, including the career that I was at the peak of at that time. Because what you and I have found is you can't buy it. People would pay millions to just get a little bit. Who was it? Cora Louise? No, it was Juanita. Said that she used to pray when she'd see a guy up the podium talking or something and sober. Oh, if my husband could just get sober. And then he got sober. Oh, if my husband would just stay sober and do that. We want more and more. Well, the more and more has been given to me. I can't say that the time hasn't gone rapidly, because it has, and I feel a little disconcerted at times that I haven't learned more, and I feel very remiss that I haven't, gone back and taken a college course on something. But it hasn't been necessary, because I've been listening to you people, and I've been reading the AA literature, and even my AA sponsor is a ding-a-ling, just like me. That's why I picked him, Larry B. from North Hollywood. And I have come to believe that we come into this life because we have a mission. We got something to accomplish, either to straighten ourselves out, to pay for something, to accomplish some kind of a mission. Whether I got sober or was allowed to get sober, given the grace to get sober, to carry this message to one other living human being who is sick and suffering. Maybe that's the only mission I have in life. And I think it very possibly could be. Because when I, in my own opinion, strip everything away from life, there's only one thing that exists, and that is spirituality. This is a spiritual program. And really, the material things don't mean that much. I like them. I like money. But they don't mean that much to me anymore because of what I have found inside. And you folks who sat down there last night at that round table discussion that we had, you don't know what you did for me by discussing these things with me, because this is part of my progress. And I've gotten to the place where I used to have a closed, very closed mind, and I've gotten to the place now where I want my mind to be open, progressive. Even if I don't believe something, I want to have an open mind. Because I think, as the book says, as the Bible says, I've heard from many, many people, we're living in eternity. We're not here today and gone tomorrow. We ain't never gone. And my sponsor has told me, Dick, if you don't shape up now in this lifetime, you may have to come back and do it all over again. My only answer is, who needs it? So I'm going to do the best I can to progress myself, and the only way that I can do it, I have read of religions, I have read this and read that, and I've gone into various things. And about 5 years ago, I have a clergyman who was a client of mine, and I'd gotten all involved in the magic power of the mind and the three magic words and all this sort of stuff, and you know, you can do anything you want to, and man, I was about to go belly up. I was so disturbed. And this guy sat there with about a year in the program. And he said, well, Dick, why don't you just work the AA program with anything that you read? And it's true. Anything I go into, I have to go into it with or from the power of the AA program. It's fine to study all these things, to tell me that whatever I put into the forebrain will be fed into the midbrain, and the midbrain will feed it into so-and-so, and it'll come out some other way. You know. All of a sudden, man, I'm out here flying around somewhere. My little monk says, why don't you just work the AA program? It's so simple. You know, I never lived until I got here. So I am not an adult. I have an adult figure. But I have the mind of a child. The difference is that the things that I used to do that were childish, I like to think that they're more childlike. Now, a guy asked me the other day, he said, an earth baby, as Howard referred to him. How you doing, Dick? And I said, have you seen my picture in the paper lately? He said, no. I said, I'm doing fine. Because I got on the front page when I got in trouble. And that's how I was supposed to do it. I don't believe there's any coincidence. You and I are supposed to be here at this moment in eternity. There are 6 to 10 million people suffering from this incurable disease. And why were we chosen? If you haven't thought about it before, you might think about it now. There was a reason. It's no coincidence. And it's no coincidence that we all met here tonight. I did a series called U.S. Border Patrol, and some of you... Oh, stop. I know you're... I know you're ahead of me. I'll bet you're a Gemini. We got on a plane to get down to Miami to make the last four shows of that particular series. And I drank what I brought with me. And then I drank what the stewardess gave me. In New Orleans, I got off and I bought a fifth because it was going pretty fast. Got back on the plane. We got airborne. And I got in conversation with two guys across the aisle from me. And I began asking them questions. Now, don't forget, I was a chief in the Border Patrol in that series. So I'd ask him questions like, where are you from? The guy says, I'm from Germany. Oh, you have a passport. He says, no, I don't have a passport. I said, you've got to have a passport. Any chief knows you've got to have a passport. Asked the other guy where he was from. He said, around, and I knew there was something wrong with him. So I had a... I had the head electrician with me, and he was pretty well bombed, too. But these guys that answered my question, I'd say, see? He said, yeah, there's something wrong with them. I'll go back at him again. Got out my notebook, and I said, I'll ask him questions, put the answers down. What do you say you do? Finally, I called the stewardess. I said, I'd like to speak to the captain, please. And she said, well, who are you, and what do you want? And I didn't tell her that I was a chief. I pulled my attaché case out from under the seat, and I had that big, the blue and gold Border Patrol insignia, you know, U.S. Border Patrol Bureau. And, ooh. I wish I was half as smart, sober, as I was brilliant when I was brilliant. Sober, I've been a very dull boy, believe me. So I am sitting up in the pilot's compartment, and I'm reading my notes, and I'm telling them. Now, my left eye was over. My wife wasn't along that night, and she wasn't supposed to be. I was supposed to do this all by myself. I read my notes, told my story, and the captain looked at me and says, what do you want me to do? I took over that ship right then. Captains of airlines don't ask passengers what I want them to do, take over the ship. I said, when you get close enough to Miami, you call your office, call the Border Patrol, tell the chief to meet me at the bottom of the ramp. I got a couple of live ones here. He said, I'll do it, and he did. The plane landed. I was the first one on down the ramp. There was no Border Patrol chief there, but there were lines of guys, by the thing, and there was a truck with a searchlight on the back of it, and I wondered who was coming in. It was me. Because the series was on down there, and the message had gotten garbled up. A Border Patrol chief has two spies on Flight 704. So here they were. As these two guys stepped off the plane, I took them by the cuffs of their coats, and I said, gentlemen, you'll remain here until the proper authorities arrive. This is citizen's arrest. And with that, the citizens also arose. These guys were cops. And they said, who are you? And I said, you said, you stand here. And they marched us across Miami Airport down into the interrogation room, put them up on a table, me in a comfortable chair. I told my story. There were six cops there. Told my story, read my notes. They glared at these guys, and they were sitting up there shivering. I got through, pulled my attaché case out from the seat, opened up, pulled out my bottle, and... Well, I was thirsty. I told a long story. The police sergeant conducting the interrogation looked at me. And he said, you gentlemen may go. And he said, you better go too. These guys didn't like what I'd done. They took umbrage. So about 3 days later, a very personable young man approached me out on a location we were doing outside of Miami. And, are you Mr. Richard Webb? I said, yes. He said, here. I said, where have you been? And three subpoenas for $250,000 against National Airlines, $250,000 against me, $250,000 against my ex-boss, and $47,000 punitive damage. Now, what was my reaction to this? Case of mistaken identity, it could have happened to anybody. But it didn't. It happened to me. Why? Because I was drinking. Because I was an alcoholic. And when I drank, I had no control. I was completely out of touch with any reality. So 4 years after that happened, which was 3 years after I came into AA, the attorneys down there notified me that I'd have to return to Miami and stand trial for it. And I called my sponsor, and I said, I ain't going. They're only after money. He said, yes. I said, I'm not going to go. He said, Richard, our book says that you will be willing to make amends. I said, I'm willing, but I ain't going. I could see myself breaking coral down in St. Augustine in a striped suit. But I went, ultimately, on National Airlines, very quietly. But when I arrived in Miami, of course, they'd pulled this out of the dead file. And it was now another big cause, and the photographers and the whole bit. And the people in California had told me, as soon as you get into Miami, call AA. Stay close. And boy, I needed help. So I called, and a clubhouse, the Friendship House, was about 6 or 8 blocks from my aunt's place where I was staying. And I went right over there, and I told her my story right off the bat. The trial was 4 days long. When court opened that first morning, all out through the audience, you guys and gals from AA, little wink, little smile. Whenever they'd have a recess, I'd get up and wink. Man, they were all around me, just, you know, wherever I went. I asked for help, and I was getting it. So at the end of the 4 days, I had to take the stand for the first time in my life, not in a movie scene, and sit up on that in that chair and tell the truth. And I told it to the best of my ability. Every once in a while, I'd think to myself, God, you know what's going on down here? Yes, God, I believe, but please help me in my unbelief. But I told the judge was, I admitted that I lied in my depositions and my statements and the whole schmear, and the judge was sitting up there, it was hot, and every once in a while he'd look at me. You know. Jury was sitting over here. They were out for about 2 hours, and they came back. Everybody got off the general charge of $250,000. Mr. Webb, guilty on the $47,000 punitive damage. And I thought, uh-huh, see, I said I shouldn't have come. Each one of the plaintiffs got $1 apiece. And I was so embarrassed for them, I couldn't look at them. The judge called me back in his chambers when it was all over, and he said, Mr. Webb, you AA members can't be beat when you're working your program. He said, you are the fourth member of AA who has been before my bench as a defendant, and you're usually a defendant. He said, you tell the truth. He said, there is no defense needed. He said, whatever you're doing, keep on doing it, because it's beautiful. And right at that moment, I decided that never again would I ever question anything about the AA program, the power of God, the presence of God, and I didn't for about 2 weeks. Because this is the type of a personality that I am. I didn't realize how sick I was when I came to this program. And as I've heard some guys say, man, if I'd known really how sick I was, I wouldn't have come. Because it's too late to go back now. Now I know too much. I have serious depressions from time to time. I wrote an article and sent it into Grapevine when I was in the midst of one of those things a few years ago, and they published it. And that seemed to help me, the reading of it. Like I was reading something written by somebody else. But I have these things. And people say, well, what step in the program were you working when you wanted to commit suicide sober? And it just seemed that my life there at one period was just a vast plateau of nothing. There wasn't even a blade of grass on it. And I wanted to go. So I'd heard that aspirin would kill you if you took enough of them, so I ground up 70 of them. I ladled them down one night, went out and got my little dog, put her on the bed, knelt down, said, God, thank you, I'll see you soon. When I woke up in the morning, I damn near died. Believe me. There I was, wrapped around a thunder mug, just like I'd been when I was drinking. God help me. My brother hadn't been out to see me for quite some time. This day he showed up. Didn't know why. Got in the car. I needed him. I was all alone in the house there. Took me over to emergency, and the doctor said, what'd you do? I said, I ground up 70 aspirin and took them. He said, you jerk. I wanted sympathy. I was sick. So he said, well, he said, they've been in you so long now. He said, it wouldn't do any good to pump your stomach, but you have ruined your liver. You've shot it. He said, I'll give you some shots and some pills, and you take that. I said, Doc, what is that blue and green and orange and red that I'm throwing up? He said, your liver. So he said, come back in a few months, and I'll check you over and tell you how much damage you've got. And I went back a few months later, and he looked me over, and he said, I don't get it. He said, you alcoholics, what you've done to your bodies over a period of years. He said, you know, there isn't one single solitary thing wrong with you physically. But, Mr. Webb. I said, yeah, I know. Now, I thought at the time that I had turned my life and my will over to the care of God. You see, I'm not even sure when I do it. Sometimes I think I've done it. But I get into these depressions. And I have at times told this story about my suicide attempt sober. And it was interesting because I also visited the Suicide Prevention Center after I pulled this little caper out there. And then I got up in a meeting, I was asked to speak, and I told all about it. And when I got through, I sat down, and the leader got up, and he said, well, there you have it. Thank you very much. Night. And everybody walked out. So I started out. I was the last one in the auditorium. As I got out to the door, the guy stepped out in the shadows and he said, could I talk to you, please? I said, yeah. He said, I was going to commit suicide tonight, but he said, I thought I'd go to one more meeting. He said, I was just hoping I could find something. You know, I think that you and I act as channels many times when we're not aware of it. So I sat and talked to him. And I felt better. I was told by a lot of people, don't get up there and say that you ever had those thoughts or you made those attempts when you were sober. I said, but it happened. And when I talked to the Suicide Prevention Center, I said, you know, come in, I'll call her up. I said, I'm a member of AA, you know. They said, well, you don't let that bother you. I said, we get about 500 members of AA a year. I said, you mean sober? They said, oh, yeah. They want to commit suicide? Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we were afraid to talk about it. Now, when we came here sick and dying, then we had, let's say, a good excuse to cop out and to tell all these things, all these, the way we felt and how we were sick and how we were dying. Now, all of a sudden, we're sober. Now, all of a sudden, we got status. Now, all of a sudden, we don't want people to think less of us. Because you've been in the program 8, 5, 10, 8, 15 years. I couldn't let anybody know that I had those thoughts that I wanted to go. That's the beginning of hiding to me. And I can't hide anymore, so man, I gotta pour it out. Like, who was it, Cora Louise said, or Juanita, I don't know. Said, if I come and share my problem, I've still got half of it, but you got the other half. And I think it works that way. I'm not at all proud of the things that I did, but I have tried to forgive myself for them. I know that I had a God-given dignity and self-respect the moment that I was born. And through the years, I destroyed this. Because there was nothing dignified or self-respectful about that character going out barefooted to choose 12 cops in the front yard to kill him. A mess. Then I came into AA and I heard the word humility. Be humble, be humble. I looked it up in the dictionary and it still didn't make any sense to me. so humble to me. Did you ever try to be humble? No, I used to stand around and try to be... Work at being humble. Go back in the corner, you know what I'm saying? It didn't work. And now, humility to me is dignity and self-respect. I can live fairly comfortably with me. I think about doing all those ding-a-ling things and maybe going up in the tree and driving my car at somebody, shooting at some guy. I have those thoughts sometimes daily. I'll drive up to a corner. There'll be some guy sauntering across, you know. I look around to see if anybody's looking. Maybe I can get him, you know. And then back over him to make sure. Where this beautiful, tremendous thing came from, I don't know. I don't question it anymore. This thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous, this program. But it has opened doors to me spiritually, not materially. It's opened doors to me that have been so fantastic, and I know that I'm just on the bare edge. I'm just beginning. These are the fringe benefits to me. As the last part of one of our chapters says, more will be revealed to you and to us as we trudge the road to happy destiny. It didn't tell me that I was going to fly, skip, jump, or hop. I'm going to trudge. And it is a trudge. I don't do, right today, as much 12-step work, personal 12-step work, as I did. Sometimes I am kind of tossed into it, but I don't actively go look for 12-step work, because I had some very unfortunate occurrences. And I usually get guys like myself. I had 56 guns in the house when I was drinking, and that's always recommended for a practicing alcoholic, to have 56 guns around. But go into a guy, and he's got the guns on him. Larry was talking about it today. I got the violent ones just like I am, but now I don't know what to do with them. Paid a call on a guy about a month ago. Big, strapping fella, bare to the waist, jump boots on. Muscles all over, sitting there crushing beer cans, and I'm thinking, oh, let me know. So I sat near the door, and there was a lamp here, you know. I had everything spotted, what I thought I was going to do. Hit him and run, you know, when he took off. Finally, he reached down in his boot, and he pulled out a switchblade. Laid it on the table, reached in the waistband, pulled out a butcher knife. Laid it down. He said, well, I guess I won't need those tonight. And I said, sure, I'm glad you feel that way. How you serve in this program, I think, is an individual thing, as long as we do it. As long as we do it. I go to a lot of meetings. I lured myself into that trap one time. I was going to 3 meetings a week, and then I started going to 2, and then to 1, and then I said, well, you know. And the little voice said, I hear the violins playing in the background. And I can't allow myself to get away from meetings. I've heard too many people say, what happened to you? I stopped going to meetings. People with 20, 25 years in the program. They go to meetings. They apply themselves. They are, to me, the winners. They're doing it. I had to come to meetings when I first came to AA. I had to. And I thought to myself sometimes, if they read that 5th chapter again, I'm going to go. Then one night I went to a meeting, they didn't read it, and I raised my hand and says, where's the 5th chapter? You and I can say things to and among us that in my experience, I've never met at any other place. And we do it with a love and an understanding. It's a therapy, yes. but there's a power working. Because I don't have to be afraid that somebody's going to put me down for saying these things. And I've gotten to the place now where if somebody does put me down, they got a problem. And I try to learn not to react. A fellow walked up to me one night just a short time ago. I'd gotten through speaking, and he walked up, and he says, "I don't like you." And I looked at him, and I said, "Well, what do you want me to do about it?" And that really flipped it. So I left before he hit me. I try to learn not to react. So there are 6 to 10 million people out there suffering who need this program. Perhaps they don't want it, a lot of them. What are we going to do about it? We're going to do our best, carry the message. But maybe things are progressing the way they are supposed to progress. You and I were given the grace, and there are many people who come to AA, get this program, they get sober, and paradoxically, they turn right around and walk out again. They go out and they take the drink from me. We have, I hear now down here, it's kind of nationwide, but we have quite a pill problem out in the West Coast. It seems for some reason people get the idea that they stop drinking, they come to AA, they get the word. Now they get a little nervous. Now they got to have a tranquilizer. One leads to two, and two leads to a bottle. I've thought about not drinking at times, but, you know, maybe I'll just take a pill. Nobody will know. I'll sit down in the clubhouse and watch these people walk in 3 feet off the floor, and I said, "Yeah, they do know." My sponsor, Larry, has told me many times, "Mr. Webb, there is no place to hide." And you know there ain't. Because there's a natural law working. And if I don't accomplish these things now,
I may have to come back and do it all over again.
I went to the hospital to have dental surgery. And my daughter, Patty, whom I had hoped would come down this time, couldn't make it, is a nurse up in Camp Lejeune. She was there, and so the doctor said, "Look, when tomorrow morning he'll probably have some pain. If he has pain, give him one of these pills." So I woke up in the morning, I had pain, she gave me one of those pills. Finally, I called her in, I says, "Patty," I said, what are those? And there was some big yellow thing. I even forget the name of it. We got a nurse gal here who would know it. But anyhow, I said, "What do they do?" She says, like, "Wow, Dad." I said, "Don't give me no more wow." You know, I learned then, and I'd said for 5 years, that I was one of the original escape artists. Man, I love to wipe out. I don't want to know. Well, I learned then that this thing of recovery is just as insidious as going into alcoholism. I don't know where or when I passed over that invisible line where I don't like to have my brain scrambled up. I don't like to preclude this change that I want to happen to me. Just that one day with that one wafer. And I couldn't think, and then, you know, I wanted to shake my head and clear out the cobwebs. And all my life, I'd love to be, you know, to feel that way. No more. Now I take one or two aspirin when I have a headache. Don't overdo those. I've convinced myself through various means that we're here in a physical form. When we exchange this one, we merely go move on to a new plane of consciousness. That we're so dense that we can't see. And you might have wondered what this little gizmo was I brought up here with someone. About 5 years ago, I spoke at a meeting, and I have a client who's a member of the clergy I mentioned before. And after the meeting, on the way home, he said, "You got holy tonight." Smart-ass monk. The next afternoon, he came bringing me a sign. And it says, "Please don't walk on the water." Just a reminder to me. Share your experience, strength, and hope with each other. And also along with that, I find in my own progression or progress, whether it's progression or not, I don't know, that I must tell what is happening to me now. And avenues have been opened up to me. We had long conversations, and I have ever since I got here, and some people may think I'm nuts, and they're not too far wrong. in certain beliefs that I have. And that one of those is, there is nothing but spirituality. In our transit here, we're merely trying to progress to get back to where we came from. God. We'll never make it, according to what I've read and heard, but we got to try. I'm living in eternity. I'm living a continuing life. What is that little song they have? As it was in the beginning, it is now and always shall be, Ed. I never believed these things. I went to a Bible school. I never believed this stuff. And I saw people being hypocritical and reprobates and the whole business. And I said, I don't like that. And I got away from it. And now I have been brought back, forced back, against my will a good deal. And now I've come simply to believe that this whole thing's bigger than all of us. And when we all stood last night and they said, please join hands. You know, I'd never done that in a meeting before. I'd heard that it was done. I'd never experienced it. And when I took the guy's hand standing next to me back there, I felt a great surge, a chill run up and down me. Like, this is right. And there was a power working. I want more of that. I came to the program in June of 1960. So, I'm not even 8 years old. I'm just about three. Emotionally. Because I've tried to surrender, and they told me that was the magic word. Give up. Give it up. I got to the place there one time where I gave up everything. I didn't even go out of the house. And I didn't work. So then my sponsor had to say, look, God wants us to be humble. He don't want us to be stupid. Get up. Get out there. Conned myself into just sitting all day long in the womb of the home. Don't go out. Take AA calls, thought platitudes. Don't go out and work. Don't pay, you know, any of these things. So when I say I'm a ding-a-ling, I'm right. I've taken ministers to meetings who are non-alcoholics. And they have said later that, in their opinion, and as closely as they can put a definition on it, this is first century Christianity. They could only ask their congregation to come down and see what it is we have. And Reverend Ed, I have seen any number of clergy at AA meetings. And I want to say something about this man that I have noted here. That's why I made mention that you perhaps had Scorpio in the midheaven. Because that not at any time since I have talked or listened to him or observed him, and our types have our antenna run out maybe 60 feet, you know, kind of, what's he doing? Is he really for real? I have never at any moment found anything but a great spirituality and a love and a oneness from this man. He was given a particular mission. He's a non-alcoholic, but what a bridge he is betwixt us and them to help carry the message. And his son, you know, you see all these hippies around. There were a couple of them on the airplane coming down yesterday, and dirty and filthy, and, you know, one guy had a little guitar with him. He's playing. I should have put him through one of those pods. And I get hopeless. I look at this, and I get revolted, and I want to throw up. Think everything's going to hell in a handbasket. Talked to this young man last night. He was in our little group down there until about 1:30 this morning. And this youngster, 12 years old, so bright, so clean, and so progressive thinking and quick. Now I don't worry too much about the human race. Just by talking to one chap over here. Because of these things. You and I have got a feeling of beauty that was born in us. And I think a lot of what we did was to hide from the crass and the gross things that were happening. And then we became crass and gross. Grosser. I did. Now all of a sudden, belly up, and here we come, down the home stretch. Find this way of living, we get our dignity and our self-respect back. Now we have the beauty again. And if you're new here, which there, many of them are, I understand, I wish that, and I hope that as time goes by, and you and I ever meet again, that you'll come over to me and say, you know, down at Monteagle, I only had a week or 2 weeks or a month in the program like Earl did. Boy, you sure did help me. Because that helps me. I need help. I need every bit of help that I can get. And you people gave it to me. And my Alabama sponsor back there, Jim, gave it to me. And Clarence, do I get the five? Thank you. Clarence, that's 10. All you people have extended your love to me, and I most sincerely appreciate it. And I will not soon forget what I have been a part of down here. And I'll carry the message of you people back to California. And they may think that I'm a sniveler when I go into detail about what you folks have got here, because it's really something special. You made my heart bigger, and you've made a better person out of me. So in our parting, my mother passed away last February, the 1st. And in trying to find something to put on her gravestone, I don't know where I found it. Probably somebody knows. But I found an inscription that I used and I want to close with. And that is, "Where has it ever been well with me without thee?" And thank you very much.